Hi, Monk Podcast listeners. The following is a sample of the Monk Members Only podcast. To access the full-length edition of this episode and all of our regular Monk Members Only podcasts, go to our website, www.monkdebates.com, and register for membership. Membership is free, and it's available for you right now at www.monkdebates.com. Hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, Monk listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, your host and moderator. Welcome to this, our Friday Monk Members Only podcast. This is our regular program where we dig into the big issues and ideas in the news, hopefully leaving you with some new analysis and insights. My guest, as always on these programs, is Janice Gross-Stein. She's the founding director of the Monk School of Global Affairs, internationally renowned scholar and author, and she's all ours for the next 30 minutes. Janice, great to be in dialogue with you. Today, what are we? Friday the 12th.
It is not good news when you get to mid-August because the time is running out. It really is.
The nights are getting a little bit cooler. You will feel that hint of it's not fall, but you know, the climate changing, the earth rotating on its axis.
Not good news.
Yeah. Well, just some news about this podcast, Janice. After almost 75 episodes, you and I have decided, you know what? It's time to get a proper name for the Monk Members podcast. I mean, Monk Members podcast, it's a name, but it's, I don't know. It doesn't, I think, rise to what we're trying to do with the show and, you know, having some fun in creating something, hopefully, that will kind of serve our audience, not just for the balance of this year, but let's hopefully, as long as you're up for it, Janice, you know, some time to come. So I wanted to kind of put a challenge out there to help Janice and me come up with an idea for the name for this podcast. If we choose your idea, I don't know, Janice, I was thinking we could dedicate an episode to a cause or issue related to the person who chooses the winning name. So if you have a favorite charity you want us to plug for you, if you have an issue, maybe it's women in Afghanistan, we'll do a segment on that topic. So a little incentive here for you to put on your thinking hats, to fire up your gray matter and come up with a proper name, a compelling name for the Monk Members Only podcast. Jess, what do you think makes for a good podcast name?
Well, let me just say this to all our listeners in full disclosure here. Rudyard and I went at this for a half an hour and then looked at what we'd come up with and said, our listeners will do better than we did. What makes a great name? It's catchy. The words in the can't be too long.
Totally.
There has to be a kind of music to the name. It's got a sound and be fun. And I think it's got to reflect both what we cover and the way we do it, the tone of the conversation. So that's really what we're looking for. We did not succeed, the two of us, and turn to you now for help and inspiration.
Yeah. So I would just stress that short is critical because it's got to fit on that little tile on the Apple podcast store. So we're talking not a lot of real estate there. So my idea of a worthy Canadian initiative was resolutely objected to by Jess. I'm just kidding. That was the famous joke about a New York Times, you know, story about the most exciting thing to come out of Canada.
what about three or four words, Rudyard, in that territory and not long, multi-syllabic words, short, snappy.
Let's do it. You can send your suggestions right now or over the weekend to podcast@monkdebates with an S, M-U-N-K, not monks like the people in the monastery, M-U-N-K, debates with an S.com. Again, podcast@monkdebates.com. And we'll, I hope, Janice, get this new name in place for September as we kick off the fall. So thank you again, listeners, for your ideas and suggestions. We really look forward to seeing what you come up with. Okay, let's get on with the show. Topic number one, Janice, has to be U.S. politics. We have just seen a insane week of action on the part of the Attorney General of the United States, sanctioned raid. It's clear that Garland, the AG, officially, formally approved this raid on Trump's Florida residence, Mar-a-Lago. Documents, 14-odd boxes taken out by FBI agents, a search warrant, which will be revealed, it sounds like, publicly, possibly as early as later this afternoon, Friday, by a judge, unsealed on the request of the AG. Janice, some suggestion, this is where I want to go to you first, some suggestion here, rumors appearing in the press on Friday that there may have been sensitive information related somehow to either America's nuclear arsenal or the nuclear arsenals of America's allies and or opponents. How damaging, how serious, if that proves out to be true, how damaging or serious would that be as a security breach and maybe for the future reputation and political prospects of Donald J. Trump?
You know, the story, the Washington Post leak that you've just described, Rudyard, that there were documents relating to nuclear programs. And as you said, it doesn't say whose programs, makes intuitive sense because Garland and the FBI just took a huge risk here. There would have to be something that they are really worried about in order for them to take the political risk that they have taken. And let me just say that top secret documents, which is what these documents would be classified at the very highest level of security, which went into detail about anybody's nuclear program, whether it's the United States, equally likely, for example, how far advanced Iran is. That's an obvious one. Although he took this when he left office in 2021, January 2021. So to some extent, those are already outdated. But no intelligence service in the world would want to trust the United States if presidents can walk away from the White House and keep in a locker, fundamentally. That's where it was. It wasn't properly secured. Keep these documents in a locker where they were vulnerable to theft. If this is the order of magnitude that they're worried about, I understand. I'll be honest. I was very concerned about the raid. I think it's enormously politically risky for the Justice Department and for the FBI. But given the order of magnitude of what might be in that box, you don't have a choice. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Janice, would be his rationale if it is nuclear codes or, I don't know, stockpile inventories of different weapons capabilities? Why would we keep that information? I know we're trying to get into Donald Trump's mind. It's not an easy thing to do on the best of days, but is it kind of like bragging rights? Like, oh, let me show you, what Iran, is doing or has, or is there something maybe more sinister here, Janice? I don't know. Blackmailing other governments or I don't understand the rationale, because he would know that he's taking a real risk here, that these documents, other Sandy Berger, General Petraeus, you can go through a long list of senior U.S. officials who have, looked at the prospect of jail time.
Yeah.
Because these laws are enforced. Like, it's no joke.
And let's just say that what Sandy Berger did or David Petraeus did, much less serious than walking off with documents. Now, we're speculating here, Rudyard, because the only person who knows the answer to this is Donald Trump. He's not going to tell us for sure. And by the way, let's just backtrack for 1 minute. Garland asked the court to unseal the indictment, but Donald Trump has a chance to object. And he's got to make that decision in the next 24 to 48 hours. He can object. Now, that puts him in a political box. How ironic.
I believe the latest news this morning is he's not objecting.
He's not objecting yet. Yeah. Because he just couldn't object. Because, you know, after ranting and railing that this there was no cause, he simply, I think, Garland boxed him in really here. So why would he do this? You know, short of these dark, sinister theories of conspiracy and blackmail and double dealing, which are running wild right now, these documents could be attached to some correspondence he had, either internally in the U.S. government, and he just took the file, or with others, and he may worry that he doesn't look great in some of these conversations. Because what strikes me about Donald Trump, when anything else, vanity. There's just megalomaniacal narcissism and vanity there. And I would think that what he took out of the files is anything that he thinks would shed a poor light on him and his behavior. So it's almost as if there's a cover letter that, you know, that he has sent to somebody, and right underneath it is the file that is driving the FBI crazy right now in the Justice Department. It could be as simple as that.
And I mean, why wouldn't he just have destroyed all this stuff? I mean, he's shown no interest in the past regarding the sanctity of court documents, the preservation of evidence, it seems, and his other civil and commercial disputes. So to what extent could he have, you know, just simply paper shredded all this? I mean, why
he could have.
Maybe there's bigger penalties, I'm sure, maybe destroying material, but how would you even prove if you destroyed it, if you shredded it all and then flushed it down a toilet in Mar-a-Lago?
Well, first of all, let's just make absolutely clear, he's not preserving these for history. This is not somebody who's saving the documents to go into a library, which he will then open up and give public access to scholars and historians, as other presidents have done. That's not Donald Trump. Look, these documents are part of his system. That's how people knew they were missing, because they're ordered and you generally know. Agencies are careful to identify documents, and when something's gone, if they are looking, they know they're missing. So shredding them, pretty risky. But more to the point, once there was a subpoena, which there was a subpoena, he could have returned them, Richard. And frankly, there wouldn't have been much of a penalty because he hadn't revealed them. Nobody in the Justice Department was looking for this fight with Donald Trump because, as I said, so politically risky for them. We saw in the first 3 or 4 days that rage is the only way to describe it among his supporters, how easy it was to whip them up into a frenzy. You know, Garland is now the subject of death threat after death threat after death threat. So in a sense, this politicized the Justice Department in an already crazily overheated political climate in the United States so that he could have given them back. And I can assure you his lawyers told him, give them back. I'm sure they did. But there is a part of Trump, and we see this now in the January 6th hearings, that his advisors were telling him, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. There's a part of him that just, he blocks out advice that he doesn't want to hear. So he's put himself really at risk now. Who would have expected? I certainly did not. I would have thought if Donald Trump and the Justice Department were going to go at each other, it would have been over the January 6th hearings. I never thought that this is the one that would have blown up this way.
Well, let's just play it a little bit where this could possibly go from here. I mean, the Republicans have shown a remarkable proclivity to kind of defining Donald Trump's deviancy down. So whether it's grabbing women in the genitals, whether it's untold lies to, you know, the public, arguably every indication of allegedly lying under oath in a variety of different circumstances, all of this, each step, each point in that kind of journey of mendacity, we've thought the GOP, the grand old party, would at some moment cut its losses and run from Trump. They still haven't done it. I mean, if this is, at the end of the day, something to do with America's nuclear weapons security, is that finally the bridge too far? I mean, it's unfathomable to think that, I don't know, just another rationalization, not simply by Donald Trump, we could expect that, but by senior figures in the U.S. Congress who have consistently and regularly, you know, normalized truly bizarre, dangerous, and arguably deeply harmful behavior to American society, democracy, and the very institutions that these people inhabit.
I think my intuition here, Rudyard, if this has to do with nuclear weapons, I think that's a bridge too far for the Republican Party, for the Republican Senate in particular. Why do I say that? The context in which this is taking place has changed so dramatically from the time that Trump left office. One, there's a hot war going on between Russia and Ukraine. And two, we've just lived through a nerve-wracking week in the Straits of Taiwan. And there is a sober realization right now that the United States faces two adversaries at the same time. Frankly, it's a nightmare for any military planner, for anybody who thinks about security. The United States is really stretched. Its stocks of weapons depleted simply by helping Ukraine. Just imagine if it finds itself in a very hot situation in the Straits of Taiwan in the near future. So anything that will touch on core national security, I think that will be a step too far. Certainly for the Republican Senate in Washington, for the GOP, which made up party activists, there will be always a core of them that will justify whatever he does. But this to me could be the game changer in the Republican Party. Not grabbing women, not lying about your business affairs, not any of that. But if it comes to core national security issues, if you look at the bipartisan consensus in Washington right now, and there is one on Russia as a threat and China as a strategic threat, there's no party division on that in Washington. And anything that would put U.S. security at risk, I think there's no way a Mitch McConnell could go along with that.
Does this ultimately, though, Janice, just to wrap this segment up, does it have to lead to Merrick Garland and the Justice Department pursuing a criminal case in order to convict Trump as a felon to thereby bar him forever running from office? In other words, are we eventually just going to have to go to the very end of the zombie movie where, you know, you think you've killed the zombie and then the zombie comes back and grabs your ankle and then you really have to drive the stake through its heart? I guess I'm maybe just so cynical about American politics today that I think it may have to go to that length. And then just to think of the divisions, the rancor, that is going to create, because there's going to be a large segment, all those, you're talking tens of millions of Americans, according to recent polling, who believe the last election was stolen, who would buy into in a moment a conspiracy theory that all this was fake, all these documents were planted, he's criminally charged. Talk about a setup for 2024.
I think it's, the zombie scenario here, to me, is that he's charged criminally and convicted, because there's no precedent in the United States for charging for, first of all, raiding the home of an ex-president, for charging, Nixon voluntarily resigned when the party told him he crossed the line. And what this does, Roger, it takes the United States to a whole new place of danger, frankly. I think we can all remember how when Trump led the chant, lock her up, we said, oh my goodness, that's not what happens in institutionalized democratic societies. You don't turn on a candidate or a former president or a former anybody and resort to the criminal justice system to deal with your opponents. Now that could happen in Brazil. It could happen in Venezuela, for sure. And we could go around the world, and talk about countries in which this happens, but it doesn't happen in well-institutionalized democracies. And when it does happen, no matter how merited it is, this is a tough argument to make, the one I'm making right now, frankly, and I'm getting a lot of pushback. But when this happens, when you criminalize former political leaders, no matter how merited it is, the political system, the fundamentals of your democratic system are put at risk because it won't be the last time that this happens. You start using the judicial system as a weapon in an all-out political struggle, which is not what we do in democracies. There are limits to political struggles in democracies. You'll lose an election. You'll lose it with grace. You're miserable. You go home and you say, what have I done with the last 4 years of my life? But you lose it because you know that either you or your successor can come back and do it all over again for the next election in relative personal safety.
But I think what's different, Janice, this time in the United States is that literally the rule of law at some level has broken down so that you have a bad actor in the sense of Trump, who is flaunting repeatedly the rule of law. So you're right. It sets up a horrible dynamic where the state, as you know, the entity with the exclusive license to define and implement and enforce the rule of law, is forced to act. I think I worry, in a sense, that's actually how bad things are in the US right now, that the rule of law is being challenged now in ways that are entirely new and destabilizing, and each action causes a reaction. And the danger here, Janice, is some kind of spiral. I mean, there was a man, unfortunately, who was shot and killed by FBI agents after he stormed an FBI field office. I believe it was in Iowa last 24 hours. So, the beginning signs of real violence now spilling out as the rule of law, the legitimacy of the state, is fractured in the minds of, again, millions of Americans.
I think that's why we should all worry, Richard, because this is a sign of a deep, deep, deep problems in U.S. democracy of the kind that it the last time it experienced something like this, people go back to the U.S. Civil War, which was fought over slavery. But that, in a sense, was a more noble fight than what we're experiencing now. This is, as you say, a bad actor. And let's just backtrack for 1 minute to close a loop here, Rudyard. Many people have argued that Garland should charge Donald Trump as a result of the January 6th insurrection, and that the January 6th committee was providing enough evidence. It's always harder, though, because you have to have a smoking gun. And there was to me, awful risk that he would be charged and they would fail to get a conviction, because that's possible. Here, this is a straight up and down case. There was a subpoena. He didn't hand over the documents. He ignored the subpoena. And if those documents contain anything related to core national security issues, a judge will have no choice, frankly, but to convict. So you get the conviction that bars him from politics through, frankly, the craziest possible decision that he makes. Crazy not to hand over the documents. But you set U.S. politics on fire, frankly.
We're going to continue to follow this closely on this soon-to-be-named podcast. A reminder to our listeners to participate, help Janice and me figure out what we're going to call the Monk Members Podcast come September. You can do that by sending us an email right now to podcast@monkdebates.com. We'll take a short break. When we come back, a little recap on Canadian politics, a kind of summer of discontent that's winding up. What does it herald for the autumn, for the fall? What are we going to see in terms of the contours of political debate in Canada? We'll have a preview for that, preview of that for you right after this short break. You've been listening to a sample of the Monk Members Only podcast. To access the rest of the episode, consider becoming a member. Membership is free and available at www.monkdebates.com. Once you've joined as a member, go to your membership profile to access the rest of this episode and all of our Monk Members podcasts. Thanks for listening.